the streets are screaming now. Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. All right, today we want to continue in our series talking about neoliberalism. And the topic today is Trump's failing neoliberalism 2.0 restoration. As we've said in the previous shows, neoliberal policies in those four key areas, industrial policy, monetary policy, fiscal policy, and external trade policy, right, hit a wall with the 2008-09 crash. Obama could not put it back together again, only partially. And to some extent, that resulted in the very slow, historic low recovery during the Obama years. Only the banks and big businesses really recovered, and big investors. The rest of Main Street did not. So we had this growth that was about 60% of historical normal in the recovery from a recession that occurred from 2010 to 16 under Obama. And by 2016, it had pretty much petered out. In other words, it was getting worse, the economy. It hit the wall. And it's important to understand Trump as a kind of reaction to that failure to restore neoliberalism and restore economic growth, even though it's always been lopsided under neoliberalism, mostly for investors and corporations and businesses, and less for the rest of the economy. But it hit a wall. And Obama couldn't restore it, and Trump is reaction to that failure to restore it and that failure of growth and recovery. And in those areas of the country that were especially hard hit, Trump had most of his support and still does. You know, because overlaid on this, a failure of recovery was a continued deepening throughout the Obama years of free trade and the loss of jobs and quality jobs and so forth, which really hit mid-America hard and kind of hollowed out mid-America. The jobs just did not come back, even lower paid jobs come back in flyover country, whatever you want to call it. They came back a little bit, even though at a lower pay in the urban areas and the coast. But not in flyover America. So, those swing states in flyover America, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, West Virginia, so forth, they swung to Trump. Of course, part of the reason they swung was the total ineptitude of the Hillary campaign, which actually ignored those states, thinking they were in their Democrats' pocket, but of course they weren't. Democrats just did not understand what was going on in the country. They thought that recovery in the urban areas was a reflection of recovery everywhere, and they assumed that Obama had restored stability and growth when he hadn't. And that's why Trump prevailed, especially in those swing states. Okay, so Trump, in prevailing, promises to restore the U.S. economy. Of course, restored on behalf, once again, even more so for corporations and investors. And that's how you should view the Trump policies, an attempt to restore neoliberalism in a more virulent, aggressive form. That's why I call it neoliberalism 2.0. And we'll talk about the dimensions of that 2.0 restoration and whether it succeeded or has succeeded. It's a work in progress, of course, and it's a mixed picture. He hasn't fully succeeded restoring it yet, although in some areas he has restored neoliberalism even more aggressively than before. Before we jump into that big question, though, I just want to give a quick review of some of the economic developments of the past week here, as we always do. I want to say something about the U.S. economy, provide a snapshot of the economy and the global economy as it continues to evolve here. You know, one of the big themes we've heard here in recent weeks is, oh, the economy has looks like it's stabilized a little bit and it's recovering a little bit. And the stock market went back up significantly. The bond markets sort of took a pause, did not continue, bond prices did not continue to rise. Yields began to rise a little bit here. All on pretty much on the news that, oh, it looks like there's a mini trade deal, you see. That's the big important development here at the beginning of the fourth quarter. And that restored business confidence, apparently, arguably, it reversed the yield curve flattening. And the stock market went back up as a result of that. And data that, the consumer is still spending. In other words, the mantra is, oh, the consumer is still holding, two-thirds of the economy is still holding it up, still spending. And the job market is still good, right? It's still solid. And the U.S. is doing so much better than the rest of the world. And therefore, you know, things aren't getting worse. Recession's not around the corner, as some were beginning to say. That's the message, right, in the media and the politicians. Well, if you look at the mini trade deal events of the past week, pretty clear that that thing is not inked yet. And it looks like they're having a hard time closing that deal. And of course, as that becomes or became evident, the markets and investors began to revert back to the soft and or declining view of the economy that was so apparent in August, last August, when the trade negotiations blew up once again. Okay, so we had this mini trade deal here in early October. And as I've talked about it before, it was really Trump agreeing and China agreeing to proposals China already put on the table a year previous. And those proposals primarily were buying U.S. Or China buying more U.S. farm goods, and China agreeing to allow U.S. companies majority ownership of its operations in China, which is what the bankers really want, U.S. bankers. That was trumpeted as, the deal, we got the deal. Well, missing in that deal, of course, were two things. The deal that was announced by Trump in Washington, two things were clearly missing. One is any resolution of the technology differences between the two economies and countries, right? Next-gen technologies, I've talked about that a lot, which I think is at the core of the dispute, and long-term especially. That clearly was taken off the table in the mini-trade deal by the U.S. Obviously, the U.S. plans to approach that, address that in phase two. And Trump more or less said so in his statements to the media and to TV audiences there. They had a big dog and pony show, you know, with the China representatives sitting there and Trump's, team there, Mnuchin and Lighthizer and so forth, you know, and a big media video event there, where Trump announced the mini deal. But, off the table was two things. One, the tech, any agreement on the tech issue. Yeah, there's some talk about, vague talk about, intellectual property. We have some agreements on that. But that's not to be confused with the tech issue, you see. Intellectual property is really about software, and a lot of that is about entertainment software. It's not really next-generation technologies, which is artificial intelligence, 5G broadband, and wireless, and cybersecurity. Those are the next-gen technologies. So that was off the table. And also not part of that mini deal was the issue of tariff reductions. China has always wanted tariff reductions as a quid pro quo for any agreement to return to purchasing U.S. farm goods. You know, the U.S. purchase, China purchased farm goods had fallen less than $10 billion and a year, or maybe that was a month, and $40 billion, that was a year, was what Trump was talking about. It was going to increase to $40, $50 billion. Well, it wasn't going to do it overnight unless Trump thought so. It was supposed to be in steps and stages. That's at the heart of the problem here, getting this mini deal signed. Trump wants to keep his tariffs and have the Chinese to increase the purchase of U.S. farm goods. Well, you can't have it without a trade-off, but Trump doesn't want a trade-off. See, Trump is very reluctant to eliminate his tariffs. Well, why is that? Well, because that's the way he shows he's tough for the election, tough on China, and that his tariff policy worked. And there's a lot of doubt and a lot of criticism that his tariffs strategy is not working. So he wants to show that it works. Plus, I think he likes the revenue. I don't know what the plans are with that revenue, but, you know, that approaching $100 billion that goes into U.S. Treasury, you know, he probably has plans of spending that somehow in right before the election, you know, not having to go to Congress for it. You know, he likes those tariffs. And tariffs have always been also at the heart of the dispute with the U.S. He's holding those tariffs and wants those tariffs as well because if he took the tech issues off the table in the mini deal and he wants to revisit them in a phase two next year, well, he needs the hammer of the tariffs in order to do so. In other words, in order to negotiate to hammer China to backtrack on its next-gen technology. If he doesn't have the tariffs, he's got no weapon. So he doesn't want to give the tariffs up just for the farm goods. He wants to use it to go after technology. And that's probably the understanding he has with the neocons, the Lighthizers, you know, and the Navarros and the military-industrial complex behind it, behind them, because they are the faction that's pushing Stop China's Technology Development because of its military implications next decade. Right, and I would guess that they probably agreed to keep that out of the mini deal, only with the understanding that Trump would keep his tariffs and that there would be a more aggressive phase two in next year going after the tech issue using the tariffs. So if Trump gives up the tariffs now, what has he got to force the tech issue negotiations in phase two? Nothing. And that's the dilemma, you see, that the U.S. team is facing. And China knows it. And China right now is not agreeing to ramp up the farm purchases unless there is a commensurate reduction in the U.S. tariffs. It's got to be a quid pro quo. And Trump does not want to do that. And that's the sticking point right now. It's over the tariffs. You know, he introduced more tariffs in September, and he announced there would be still more tariffs coming in December. And my guess is, you know, he's maybe willing in stages to postpone the December tariffs, but he's not willing to backtrack on the September tariffs. And China doesn't like that. No. And China's been burned on this tariff issue with Trump before. They probably don't trust him. When? Well, when the trade deal broke up, driven by the neocons last May, what happened was Trump and President Xi met again at the G20 meeting in Osaka in June, and Trump, according to China, agreed not to impose more tariffs to Xi. But then in August, he did just that. In other words, he lied to Xi, and he raised tariffs on the advice of his neocons who want to scuttle any deal. He raised tariffs in August, and China responded with tariffs, more tariff increases of its own, and more importantly, started letting its currency, the yuan, devalue, you see. And that caused a big heartburn in the financial markets in the U.S., and they really tanked. And it looked like it was going to be another fourth quarter 2018 big contraction of stock prices. And the bond prices went up, and reciprocally. Trump quickly backed off of that and announced in August, we'll consider, maybe removing the tariffs again if you guys meet with us. And then negotiations in backroom went on the way in September, and they met in early October. Okay, that's a little bit of the background and the history of this. But China, I'm sure, felt they've been burned on promises of tariff reduction, and they're not going to take any ambiguous, vague promises by Trump that he'll withdraw tariffs after you start buying more farm goods. I don't think China is dumb enough to fall for that one. But that's the way Trump operates. In other words, you do what we want you to do, and then maybe we will take off the pressures. Of course, that's the way U.S. sanctions work everywhere. Right? You could see it very clearly with North Korea. Hmm? The U.S. slaps sanctions on North Korea, meets with North Korea, and says, if you dismantle your missiles and your nuclear program, then we'll talk about withdrawing the sanctions. Well, that's not negotiations. North Koreans say, let's do it in stages. We'll dismantle some, remove some sanctions. Well, the U.S. isn't going to do it that way. That's not the way the old arrogant U.S. that, sees itself as the global superpower, the hegemon politically and economically, prefers to negotiate. It's not really negotiations, right? It's do what we want you to do, and then maybe we will do partly of what you want us to do in turn. Right? So China's not following for that game with the tariffs, you see, and that's where we are, and that's why things are kind of stuck right now with the mini deal. And Trump has to decide, right, to what extent he's going to, in order to placate his farm sector, which daily is in more and more trouble, particularly small, medium-sized farmers. 12,000 farms went bankrupt. And if you read the past week, the big dairy farmer or dairy goods producer, I forget the name of the company, that filed for bankruptcy as well. So the farm sector is really beginning to feel the burn here. Despite Trump's $28 billion subsidies to it, which mostly go to agribusiness anyway. So he's got to decide, Trump, whether he wants to do tariff reductions to get a deal for China to ramp up farm goods that he can announce before the elections, or, whether he wants to keep those tariffs in his back pocket and placate the military-industrial complex of the neocons, who know that if you don't have the tariffs, there's no way you're going to get China to really negotiate and compromise on next-gen technologies. And you may not even get it if you do have the tariffs, China knows the importance of those technologies, and they're not going to give them away. Okay, So that's what's going on the trade side. And, of course, the longer this thing goes on, drags on, does not get resolved, business uncertainty grows and investment, real asset investment, to expand production and therefore jobs and incomes does not occur. And we see that very clearly in the U.S. economy. Second quarter, contraction of real investment. Third quarter, contraction of real investment. As part of that, manufacturing contracting. And we'll talk about this a little bit more. Again, every quarter, every month, the manufacturing sector and business investment, the most important driving sectors of the U.S. economy, are contracting. It hasn't spilled over into consumption yet. What it has to do is impact jobs and hiring. We're at a stage where business contraction and investment and manufacturing has meant no hiring or a slowdown and no hiring. It hasn't meant layoffs yet. When it does, it will hit the consumer consciousness and the consumer will withdraw. And we see in the job market for the last 6 months this sort of wavering in the job creation. You know, it's barely over 100,000 a month, 120,000, 30,000 a month now, whereas a year ago it was twice that. What's happening is the real jobs, the good-paying jobs, just aren't being added anymore. And what we got is a continued addition of service, low-paid service jobs and part-time gig other jobs that I believe aren't really being picked up accurately. In other words, their second, third jobs to a greater proportion than ever before, not picked up accurately by the Labor Department. Well, that's another issue, right? And that's my speculation on that. Okay, so watch the job market, watch the job numbers, watch the layoffs by big corporations when they start laying off 1,000, 10,000 and announcements and so forth. Then you know that the job market is cracking. And the longer the tariffs go on, the more there's going to be problems as well in consumption. And those problems are a reflection of the tariffs raising import prices. Chase Bank research estimated that given the September tariffs, if they remain, this year $1,000 on average per household will hit each household spending because of higher prices. And if they got to pay higher prices, $1,000 more, they're going to buy less of something else, and retail sales and consumption are going to weaken. Right? In other words, the problems are going to spill over into the consumption sector, two-thirds of the economy. And we're on the cusp of that, you see. We're on the cusp of that. Very clearly, last month, in October, again, a negative 0.6% decline in manufacturing filings. September's negative 0.5%, right? Some of that may have been due to the GM strike, but nonetheless, a continued contraction going on for months now as the U.S. joins the global manufacturing recession. And we had a contraction of several tenths of a percent in real investment going on second and third quarter here. Consumption, the only thing holding it up. However, there were some troubling signs in consumption as well. Retail sales in September were down 0.3%, the first decline in 7 months. Okay, in October it bounced back apparently to 0.3% of 1% growth. So last 2 months is kind of a flat negative, right? But if you look at price increases and retail sales, where are they hitting? Electronic goods, appliances, furniture, restaurants, right? This is where retail sales are weakening, even last month when we have the 0.3% growth. Well, why did we have the growth? Mostly auto sales and gasoline prices. Auto sales, right? I believe because well, this is the, you know, the fall, they introduced new autos and a lot of discounts, a lot of promotions by the auto companies. I think GM engaged in extra promotions as well to move autos inventory during the strike. And of course, Ford and Chrysler knew they were up next in negotiations, so they were doing the same. Right? Let's get that inventory off the lots here, even though we got to give better promotions to do it, because we don't know what's going on with the UAW and the strikes. Okay, so I think this boost in retail sales, driven by auto and gas prices, of course, gas prices because of a brief increase in global oil prices. I believe this is temporary, and we will probably return to a flat to modest decline in retail sales going forward here. Once again, more like September rather than October. At some point, you know, it hits the household, the consciousness of households, the layoffs if they come, and rising prices because of tariffs and other factors. Then consumption starts to wane, and that feeds back on already declining manufacturing and investment, exacerbates that more. And if it looks like consumption is weakening, finally, retail sales, most of consumption is weakening, then you will begin to see the layoffs. And then now all that feeds back on itself. And all of, you know, the declines start feeding back on each other in the various areas. Okay, so we're on the eve of that. And short term, you get a little boost up, you know, short term, a little decline, so forth. It's churning. The economy is churning as it slowly slides towards stagnation. Right? Okay, and globally, what do we got? Well, Germany just narrowly averted a recession. Last quarter, third quarter, 0.1% growth, following second quarter of 0.2% decline. Well, that's statistically insignificant. Germany is stalled, and if Germany economy stalls, so does the Eurozone in turn. Industrial production, manufacturing everywhere in Europe contracting. Germany is in the weakest position since its last recession in 2013. The total Eurozone 19 country economy growing only 0.2%. Japan rapidly falling back into stagnation. Second quarter, it was a 1.8% GDP growth. Third quarter, only a 0.2%. You know, when you're down 0.1%, 0.2%, it means stagnation. It means it's stalled. And it could tip either way. It could easily tip quickly into recession. And even the U.S. economy, starting out at 3.1% GDP at the first quarter of this year, now will come in, I believe, well below 2%. Third quarter was 1.9. I think it'll be about 1.7, maybe even less in the fourth quarter of this year. Well, you know, that's a halving, one half of the growth rate at the beginning of the year. And yet, you know, you get Fed Chairman Powell saying, oh, the U.S. economy is in good shape. It's the star economy of the global. Well, you know, 1.7% is really the slow growth stagnation rate under Obama. We're back to where Obama is. The economy under Obama, if it's 1.7% GDP, we're right back where we were under Trump going into 2020. Okay, so that's the roundtable review I would offer here for the global and the U.S. economy, slowly sliding towards less and less growth in Europe, even in Japan, even more so stagnating, right? And of course, China growth is slowing rapidly. So is in India. South Korea, I think, says it's in recession. Australia, right? And Latin America is even in worse shape, you know, and political responses to that breaking out everywhere in Latin America. So the global economy is in worse shape, yes, and the U.S. is in relative better shape, but not so great, and sliding towards stagnation, I believe. And we'll see where that goes here in subsequent quarters. Okay, let's fast forward to the theme that I announced at the beginning of the show, which is to continue this analysis of neoliberalism. And by the way, once again, it's the analysis is in great detail, far more than I'm talking about here, in my just-released book, The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Economic Policy from Reagan to Trump. Clarity Press just published this past month. You can go to my blog, jackrasmus.com, where you can listen to this, today's show and all the previous shows here on neoliberalism in the last three weeks. And you can order the book there at discount, 20% off. Just click on the icon, and that will take you to the website and PayPal. And you can purchase the book there, all right, in much, much more detail. Right. And by the way, the major themes of the book are that most books written about neoliberalism to date miss a lot of what neoliberalism is about. You know, they typically talk about, the idea of free markets and efficient markets. In other words, they approach it in a very idealist way based on ideas. But as I point out in the book, those ideas associated with neoliberalism, whether it's privatization and austerity and so forth, are really not what neoliberalism is about. In fact, neoliberalism in practice is quite different than the idea of neoliberalism. And I don't think a lot of critics, particularly progressives on the left, they fall into the neoliberalism as idea trap, and they don't quite understand neoliberalism in practice, its history. I have a two-part article coming out next issue of Z Magazine, and the first part is really contrasting the idea with the history and the practice. That also is on my blog and on my website. Just go to jackrasmus.com. So these shows where I'm talking about it and where I'm writing articles and printing about it are all available on jackrasmus.com and my website, which is kiklosproductions.com. All right, so, the theme of the book is this idea that the critics of neoliberalism are only criticizing it from a perspective that is only partial, even when they look at it in practice, the policies of neoliberalism. But a lot of it is they get wrapped up into the idea, which has nothing to do with neoliberalism. In fact, it has nothing to do with liberalism. As I point out in Chapter 1 of the book, classic liberalism is really quite different than the neoliberal idea, the ideas of neoliberalism. And I show and contrast, you look at the writings of Adam Smith and David Hume and others at the time, classic liberal economists, their propositions were quite different than the neoliberal idea propositions, right? One of my themes and arguments is, neoliberalism is really about certain practices and policies, and then to justify those practices and policies, the advocates of neoliberalism draw on and distort and pervert ideas of classic liberalism to justify the policies. So it's not that ideas, intellectuals, economists in the 70s and so forth, Milton Friedman and Friedrich Hayek before him, I point out who they are. It's not that they created these ideas and then Thatcher and Reagan run with these ideas. No, it's quite the opposite. It's that the big capitalists come up with the policies and the ideas in the 70s, start implementing them, and to justify them, they reach back into classic liberalism and pull forward certain ideas and distort them and whatever, efficient markets, you know, free trade, all that stuff, and use it to justify the policies, right? In other words, neoliberalism as an idea is really ideology. You know, what's ideology? That's where you you distort purposely, intentionally, you distort the meaning of ideas in order to use them to justify the interest, advancing the interests of a certain segment, i.e. capitalists and investors. Right? That's what ideology is. You know, ideology is not an ism. Ideology is misrepresentation of fact and truth. So neoliberalism as idea is mostly ideology and misrepresentation, as I point out in chapter one of the book. And then I go on to talk about neoliberalism in fact, in practice, in history. And that's where this new policy mix defines neoliberalism in the four key areas of fiscal policy, monetary policy, trade, external policy, as we call it, and industrial policy. In the crisis of the 70s, these policies come together in a new way, a new combination that didn't exist before. You know, there's always been fiscal monetary policy, industrial trade policy, right? But in the post-World War II period, it had a certain elements to it and a certain mix and relationship between the four areas. Well, neoliberalism changes that mix, comes up with a new set of policies that relate to each other in those four areas in different ways. But the objective is this: to maintain twofold, two objectives. One, to check and counter challenges, domestic challenges, whether from unions and union labor or from social movements demanding certain social spending and so forth, right? To check that and throw it back on the defensive, roll it back. And secondly, to deal with increasing challenges from foreign capitalist competitors. You know, that's what the new policy mix called neoliberalism was really about. Quite different than the policy mix that emerged after World War II, which was even different from the policy mix that was established around World War I, right? And I talk about restructurings of the economy in which the new policy mixes play a key role. You know, the U.S. economy was restructured in a major way on the eve of World War I. And during World War I, it was restructured in a major way coming out of World War II, Bretton Woods agreements and so forth, right? And the restructurings are designed to, have been designed in the U.S. to raise U.S. Capitalist power and influence and control globally. In the World War I restructuring, the U.S. comes off as an equal to Britain and other Western European capitalists that it wasn't before. And the restructuring after World War II, the U.S. comes off as the hegemon. You know, and all the others are secondary. In a way, you know, Japan and Europe become satellites, economic satellites of the U.S. economy, especially Japan. You know, these restructurings and the policy mixes of the time serve to elevate U.S. capitalist economic power and do so successfully, but they don't last forever. After several decades, two, three, four decades at most, what happens is there's new challenges to the U.S. dominance, and the policies have to be rearranged, you see, and restructured. And that's what neoliberalism was about. It was a response to the crisis of the 1970s economy, where the old policy mixes no longer worked, and a new mix had to be developed and was developed, and that was neoliberalism in the U.S., Reaganomics, and in the UK, Thatcherism, you see, response to the crisis, to a material crisis. A lot of the critics of neoliberalism don't pay enough attention to the material origins that drive these policies and these crises and restructurings that go on. Capitalism is a very dynamic system and responds very dynamically to its crises, always, at least in the U.S., has been, less so in Europe, getting more tired. But U.S. capitalists are very vigorous and anticipate the most aggressive form of capitalism, therefore aggressive restructuring. Neoliberalism was a third restructuring, you might say, and it evolved, and I have chapters on its evolution from Reagan. It wasn't fully developed under Reagan, though fundamental elements were there, and it continued to expand. As I said in the book, a chapter on George Herbert Walker Bush about that was the consolidation of neoliberalism. And then we get a renewed expansion of it, particularly in external trade relationships, but also industrial and other areas under Clinton. And then with George W. Bush, we have, as I call, neoliberalism on steroids. And then we have Obama, and we have neoliberalism on opioids. In other words, in trouble, right? Drugged, can't fully recover. And then, of course, we got Trump's neoliberalism 2.0 restoration as an attempt to come up with an even more aggressive form of neoliberalism in response to the failure of Obama to restore it. And then the question becomes, well, how successful is Trump in restoring it? Well, what are the main propositions of neoliberalism? Let me just restate those as I did last week here. First of all, it always involves a significant expansion of U.S. war defense spending. And we've seen that over the history since Reagan, right? That's a major element of it on the fiscal side. A subsidization of investors and business profits via continual, chronic, and ever deeper business investor tax cuts. And we've been seeing that from the very beginning, but especially in the last several decades since George W. Bush, $15 trillion in tax cuts for investors and corporations under Bush, continued under Obama, who simply expanded and continued the Bush cuts. And then we have Trump, who comes in, promises $5 trillion more in tax cuts for businesses during the election, and delivers at least $4 trillion of that already. Yeah. It's not a $1.5 trillion tax cut, it's a $4 trillion over the decade, of course, a tax cut, because most of these estimates of tax cuts in the media do not at all or underestimate at best the tax cuts that the multinational corporations are getting offshore, you see. They don't factor that in. Pretty much eliminated all offshore profit taxation in the U.S., now under Trump. So massive tax cuts, ongoing, chronic, right? A shifting of tax burdens to payroll taxes and other regressive taxes. That's part of the tax policy, too. Reductions in social program and social benefits spending. That's been in the mix from the very beginning. You know, social spending, war spending, defense spending, tax cutting. That's all part of what we call fiscal policy. And we want to say, well, how has that succeeded or continued or expanded, restored under Trump fiscal policy? And then there's restructuring of external and currency relationships as U.S. capital strengthens its hegemony over its corporate or capitalist challengers elsewhere, be they in Europe or China or wherever. External trade and currency relationships, currency exchange rates, right? The U.S. dollar relative to other currencies. You see, that's part of neoliberalism as well. It's not just the trade war. It's not just free trade treaties. Yes, that's part of neoliberalism external policy. But you've got to look at currency policy, exchange rate policy, and U.S. foreign direct investment policy. That's all part of not just goods flows, which is free trade, but money capital flows. That's part of neoliberalism as well. And most of the critics don't understand what's going on with exchange rate policy and what I call the twin deficits, which we've talked about here before, the relationship between goods flows and money flows, goods flows, exports, imports to the U.S., and corresponding money flows as the money dollars are recycled back to the U.S., and how the U.S. is using that recycling of hundreds of billions of dollars every year to allow it to run a budget deficit that's created by war spending and tax cutting, you see. They make up the difference to the loss of the U.S. Treasury by cutting taxes and increasing war spending, creates deficit, right? Well, the money is coming from the recycling back to the U.S. from all the U.S. economic allies around the world, and even China, right? They repurchase, and everywhere, trillions of dollars of holdings of U.S. Treasury bills and bonds and so forth. And to some extent, the recycling of the money by allowing U.S. allowing these other countries to purchase other companies in the U.S., albeit not technology or critical companies. You know, you could purchase golf courses and stuff like that, right? And buildings in New York City that nobody wants. But we're not going to let you, purchase any of our key technology companies. You know, like this Chinese company Broadcom a couple of years ago attempted to purchase Qualcomm, which is a critical technology company in U.S., and Trump and the capitalists squashed that real quick, right? And, of course, that now Trump and others are going after ZTE Corp and Huawei and just about all these other areas where China is trying to purchase, recycle its money, dollars, by purchasing tech companies. That's no longer being allowed. Okay, so critics of neoliberalism don't understand fully the true picture of the economics of neoliberalism. Yeah, they understand neoliberalism has something to do with social program austerity. It has something to do with defense spending increases and war increases. It even has something to do with lopsided tax cutting for corporations and investors. But they don't understand the trade side, other than free trade. They don't understand currency exchange rate policy, money flows, the financialization of the global economy, which has been pushed by the United States. That's part of neoliberalism, right? They don't understand why Trump is against free trade. Well, he's against multilateral free trade. He's not against bilateral free trade. He's a free trader. Yeah. But they don't understand a dollar exchange rate policy and how it's a low dollar. You see, it's part of neoliberalism. Ensure a low-dollar policy, because a low-dollar policy, right, means U.S. corporations that have flooded the world with foreign direct investment and purchases, bought up companies around the world. They call it, globalizing the supply chain. You know, it's what they call it, supply chain. And even in purchases in operations in China. You know, 49% of all the Chinese goods coming in the U.S. are somehow produced by U.S. corporations in whole or part in China. All right. So a low dollar exchange policy is part of neoliberalism. And the twin deficits that I just described are also part, critical, central, strategic to U.S. neoliberal policy. And that's all trade or external policy. And what about monetary policy? Well, monetary policy is flooding the economy, the U.S. economy, and the world economy with excess dollars, right, in order to keep interest rates chronically very low. Because you got to keep interest rates low if you want to keep the dollar low. If interest rates rise, then the dollar rises, and that's not neoliberal policy. All right. So, you know, what's called flooding liquidity into the economy through the central bank has been neoliberal policy since the late Reagan period. Right? Quantitative easing is an example of that. And the Fed's latest foray in that direction is the hundreds of billions it's now pumping into the repo markets, which is kind of like QE light, even though it denies it. Industrial policy is the fourth leg of neoliberal policy. Obviously, that means industry deregulation and privatization of public goods, services, and programs. That's always been part of neoliberalism. The destructions of unions and collective bargaining and compressing real wages and privatizing benefits, social benefits like, you know, healthcare, negotiated healthcare and so forth, right? And wage compressions, delaying minimum wage, eliminating protective wage legislation, not adjusting it, encouraging the growth of contingent labor employment, offshoring of jobs, encouraging the displacement of labor with capital by means of automation, big wave coming with AI now, and by allowing companies to import lower paid skill work via H-1B, L-1-2 visa. You know, that's all wage compression policy under neoliberalism. So those are the four areas with a little content behind it of neoliberal policy. So, you know, remaining time, how has Trump performed here? Well, he succeeded in restoring a more virulent neoliberalism 2.0 in some areas, and he's so far failing in other areas. So he hasn't totally succeeded yet, and I predict he's not going to, nor will his successor. Okay, why? Well, what has he succeeded in doing? Corporate investor tax cutting, big time, succeeded beyond capitalists' wildest imaginations here, right? 22% of the 27% increase in Fortune 500 companies' 2018 profits were due to the tax windfall. 22 of 27%, right? Big tax windfall, big profit boost in 2018. But it did not translate into real investment that creates more production, more jobs. No. Second, third quarter this year, negative. In other words, $4 trillion in tax cut, well, about $300-400 billion that hits in 2018, dissipates almost overnight. It does not result in big increase in investment, business investment. $15 trillion since George W. Bush. Yeah, that's a failure in the economy. Subset. Well, but you know, the owners, the capital corporations, do get the tax cut. So he did subsidize them big time. Right? What about war defense spending element of fiscal policy? $100 billion a year increase. You know, marginally, nicely, neoliberal. Right. Plus, he's announced the new space military arm. He's ending agreements with Russia, which means more tactical nuclear arms production coming. And who knows what the black budget of secret military projects actually is costing now. We know over a decade ago it was $75 billion a year. Easily must be over $100 billion a year. I think most of the increases in war defense spending are being secretly pumped into that particular area. So he succeeded in war defense spending in very neoliberal ways, just as he succeeded in big tax cutting. What about social program spending cuts? That's part of neoliberalism. Well, he hasn't succeeded there because what he's done is compromise with Congress to maintain levels of social spending in exchange for raising levels of defense spending. So he hasn't succeeded there. And because he hasn't succeeded there, the deficit and the debt keeps rising, over $1 trillion now, and $1 trillion for the next 8 years, $21.5 trillion of U.S. debt going to $35 trillion. The government budget office, Congressional Budget Office, forecast $900 billion in interest on the debt alone, well over $30 trillion by the end of 8 more years. Right. So total failure on deficit and debt fiscal policy, just as total success on war spending increases and tax cutting, but a failure to cut social programs, spending, which is always austerity, if you will, always part of neoliberalism. What about industrial policy? Well, very successful initially in deregulation, particularly environment and banking and industry deregulation. So, yes, we give them a plus on restoring that. Privatization, that's going along, public lands, wireless spectrum, chipping away, eliminating Affordable Care Act. Yes, okay, industrial policy there. Wage compression, what's his record there? Well, they say wages are growing 3%, but as I've said on previous shows, no, they're flat or negative for most of the workforce. Only the very high end is enjoying increases. High end meaning 10-20%. Trade policy, big failure here, right? Restoring trade, where the U.S. is the hegemon. We see with the mini China deal, that's the best he's gotten, and he hasn't gotten that yet either. Other trade wars, phony trade wars, right? All of them. Exchange rate policy, failure there as well. Why? Because his trade policy is contributing a slowdown to business investment and trade around the world. That's creating a differential between U.S. growth and foreign growth. You know, the rest of the world's at stagnation or approaching it or in recession. And the money capital is flowing out of those countries, a wall of money, and even Trump calls it, into the U.S., driving up the value of the dollar, which is negating another neoliberal policy of maintaining chronic low value of the dollar. So his trade policy, exchange rate policy, is negating his monetary policy. That's why he's leaning on the Fed, you see. He wants the Fed to lower interest rates to offset, if you lower interest rates, it will reduce the value of the dollar, to offset the rising dollar because of the flood of money coming into the U.S. economy from abroad. Well, that wrecks the trade, the twin deficit idea, too, especially if the trade war falls apart. I mean, the trade agreements fall apart and China devalues and other currencies devalue. Well, that devaluation will offset the tariffs. That's why he's so concerned in the trade negotiations to make sure China does not, quote, manipulate its currency, you see, let it, as it threatened to do in August, allow it to devalue, which would offset the U.S. tariffs. So big failure so far in external trade policy, particularly in exchange rate, twin deficits, and bilateral free trade. Right? Monetary policy, a mixed picture here. He's forced the Fed to reduce interest rates 3 times here as a way to offset the rising dollar and his failure on the trade policy side. And the Fed has fallen in line. It looks like it's beginning to balk a little bit with further cuts, but it's agreed not to sell off its balance sheet, which would reduce rates even further. Raise rates, excuse me, even further. So it's winning the he's winning the war with the Fed, right? And the Fed is pumping in money in the repo market. So a very mixed picture for Trump neoliberal restoration. Fiscal policy, yes, but not social programs. Industrial policy, yet, but not, industrial policy. External policy, big failure. Monetary policy, mixed. It hasn't been restored. And we'll talk about why his successor next phase will not be able to restore it either.